The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Orthodox Nationalist. Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson is a former professor, a professional writer, and a priest of the Ukrainian Orthodox Church. His website is russjournal.com. That's russjournal.com. Now here's your host, Matt Johnson.
Okay, everybody, welcome back to another edition of The Orthodox Nationalist. This program is a show revolving largely around Russian Orthodox nationalism and Eurasianism. Eurasianism as a, not only a political doctrine, but as a philosophy of history. And one of these days I'm going to get to a show dedicated entirely to Eurasianism and Eurasianism as a specific view of world history. This show is a nationalist show, and we've spoken about nationalism, although never really in the abstract, and that's another question for another time, what nationalism is and its relationship to social nationalism, or the idea of combining certain features of socialist economics with a strong interest in ethnicity, religion, and tradition. Today, I want to talk about a region that I've spoken about before, although only briefly. Recently, I've done actually quite a bit of research on Burma in Southeast Asia and the military government as quite officially as a national socialist system. And I think that national socialism, which is, you know, I mean, I'm taking national socialism as something not identical with Hitlerism. You know, I mean, there are plenty of socialists out there who aren't enamored with Lenin and Stalin, and there's national socialists out there who are not enamored necessarily with Hitler. So, but there are several official national socialist states. China is one, I think. Burma is another. Syria is another. Belarus is another. And the one thing that they have in common is that they're hated and loathed by the system, by the New World Order. Something else they have in common is that their currency is controlled by the state. And I want to make a fairly broad claim here that the real definition of democracy in the Western world, the journalists and the academics, you know, the two pillars of modern corruption, the definition of democracy really is who controls the currency. It's not an accident that every country that George Bush and John McCain put on the axis of evil have two things in common. Number one, they all oppose Israel. And number two, they will not allow the currency to be controlled by foreign banks. And that's certainly the case in Burma. So why is Burma so important? Burma's important for a bunch of reasons. Number one, it's important because clearly the system views it as important. The CIA is all over Southeast Asia and is all over Burma. George Soros has made his Burma project a major source of his international advocacy. Number two, of course, drugs. The opposition to the military government is largely fueled by tribal ethnic minorities, as well as the Burmese Communist Party in the extreme north of the country. They have monopolized the drug trade, and much of the opium coming through Central Asia into Russia and Europe is controlled by these forces, which strongly suggests that both Mossad and CIA, who have a strong presence in Burma, are heavily involved in this drug trade. It also explains George Soros' interest in it, because on the one hand, he wants to get his hands on the poppy crop, and on the other, he wants heroin and other poppy connected drugs, narcotics, legal in America, so that he could monopolize and dominate that market. Remember, the drug legalization movement in America is almost exclusively financed by George Soros. Normal, which I think dedicates itself only to marijuana, is exclusively a creation of George Soros. Number three, Burma is important because China views it as absolutely central to its economic life in Southeast Asia. China has, to a great extent, colonized the northern part of Burma, and has spent a fortune in developing its infrastructure. If there is a war between India and China, and there are commentators, an Asia specialist, who are predicting a war between Asia and China, Burma is going to be one of its main, one of its main theaters. And the Chinese have built military bases, especially naval bases, on the Bay of Bengal, and India has taken the Chinese presence in Burma as a major threat. Number four, ideologically, Burma is, as I've said before, a national socialist system. There's a paper out called The Burmese Way to Socialism, which is a much older paper. It predates the 1988 military coup. But it lays out what really is an Asian version of national socialism. It's socialism, but it's a socialism based largely around tradition, agrarianism, and the maintenance of independence and sovereignty. The creation, in other words, of a multipolar world rather than a unipolar world, which is the explicit goal of the New World Order. Lastly, Burma is important because it has one of the most powerful militaries in Southeast Asia. It is a member of ASEAN, or the Asian version of NATO. And that clearly, the major banks of the world view Burma as a threat, as does the IMF and the World Bank, both of whom have been kicked out of the country, as Lukashenko did in Belarus. And the fact remains that Burma is one of the CIA's main bases in Southeast Asia. And to some extent, the CIA's operations in Burma are proof, or one of the many proofs, that the CIA is involved in the drug trade, and in the process of attempting to monopolize these sources, they have financed the ethnic separatist movements, as well as the so-called democracy movement, which is almost exclusively a CIA creation. The Dalai Lama in Tibet also is financed, in fact gets a regular salary every year from the CIA. To think that the CIA is not involved in Southeast Asia is ridiculous. CIA has been tremendously involved in that part of the world since the 1950s, and Burma is a major oil exporter, a major natural gas exporter, and is also sitting on quite a bit of mineral wealth. And again, this is one of the reasons that Burma is becoming a sore point between the Indians and the Chinese. So her significance is fairly substantial. And the war over her is largely a war of information. And as far as Americans are concerned, a war of disinformation. So I start off by making two claims. Number one, that since the Burmese military control the currency, that keeps Western bankers out of the country. And that's really the main reason why there's a lot of hatred in the press for Burma. And number two, I want to lay out another hypothesis here, that As far as American media elites and academic elites are concerned, the tendency seems to be that the more obscure the country, the easier it is to lie and make up stories about the country. So in other words, a country like Serbia or Montenegro, a country like Syria, Armenia, Kazakhstan, North Korea, Burma, the average American knows exactly zero about these things. The average congressman knows exactly zero about these things. The average university professor knows exactly zero about these places. Because of the ignorance, congressmen, NGOs financed by, you know, major corporate and banking institutions, journalists all over the place could really just make up stories, because there's really no way, outside of a handful of specialists out there in the world, and they're specialists and are largely financed by these same people through their grant money and everything, so they really are in no position to say anything. You can't verify any of this stuff. So if you're a journalist, you want to pad your own career, you could just repeat all of the slogans and attacks on these countries, and for the most part, no one's really going to call you on it, because these countries are obscure. That's much harder to do with some place like Mexico or Canada or Great Britain. These are not obscure. It's much harder to lie about those countries or to make up stories about those countries. So that's another important question. Since most people don't know the first thing about Burma, it's very easy for journalists to simply make up a story, totally unverifiable, and then claim that it's news. And that's exactly what's happened. And when you've had every major Western power attacking and condemning Burma, then you know that there must be some very close economic interest that's at work here. Years ago, I wrote a paper with Michael Collins Piper on Burma that was translated into Japanese by somebody. And I wanna kind of supplement that now. That was about 6-7 years ago I did that. And I wanna talk a little bit more about it. And I wanna talk more about it because, you know, very few people know anything about it. And clearly, it's a target of the New World Order. Burma is going to be kind of like, you know, a little bit like Kosovo in the sense that it's a potentially wealthy place that, that although small and fairly obscure, is very, very important to the New World Order, to the major banks, to Soros, to all of these people that collectively formed the regime. Unlike Kosovo, Burma is not an attractive military target. We're going to talk about that in a little bit. But what I'm trying to say is that Burma seems to be kind of a test case to see to what extent you could make up stories about a country and then justify attacks on that country based on those stories. Now, a lot of my information, I know I've mentioned before on this show that my wife was raised on Taiwan, the island of Taiwan, and she's from a military family, and so she was raised there and went to high school there, and so speaks Mandarin Chinese fluently. She's not Chinese; she's of German background, but she lived there for a long time. And a lot of the information and news and the studies and the work on Burma is actually in Chinese and hasn't been translated at all and probably won't be. My wife has been able to kind of give me the gist of some of these studies and some of this work. And so this is purely exclusive information that no one, I'm sure, including the State Department, really doesn't have access to. And even if they did, probably really doesn't care. So what I want to do tonight is I want to talk about Burma, I want to talk about social nationalism, military rule, and I want to defend the country and government of Burma, both prior to the 88 coup, which was also a military government, although a different military government, and then the creation of the State Law and Order Restoration Council and its successor today, and the achievements of Burma under extremely harsh circumstances have been nothing other than stellar, especially if you can read the Chinese studies and work on the country, because as far as China's Asia strategy, Burma is China's keystone. And that in and of itself requires intelligent Americans to be aware of the situation. All right, after the military coup of 1988, the new military government wanted to engage the Chinese. Now, while the Chinese have largely colonized the northern part of Burma, the economic and military relationship between Burma and China, of course they share a long border, is very important and is central. But at the same time, there have been areas of disagreement. The main area of disagreement is the role of the Burmese Communist Party, which exists almost exclusively in the northern part of the country. They're technically a Maoist party. They were at least at one time supported by China, but they're one of the main focal points of the drug trade. Now, this never comes up in any of the Western news stories on Burma. The Burmese Communist Party is not really a political movement. It's like Shining Path in Peru. These are largely drug gangs that have taken this leftist ideology in hopes of gaining the support of Western journalists. And then, of course, also the support of China, or at least the protection of China. That's probably no longer the case, but a decade ago it was the case. The Burmese Communist Party is nothing but a drug gang that is militarily involved in protecting the poppy farmers in the northern part of the country, and of course they finance themselves by shipping, whether it be the raw poppy material or in fact finished heroin, to Thailand, and then of course all points north and west. The only reason that Burma has banned the Communist Party, because it's really not a Communist Party, it's just a drug organization. But I should note that there are 42 registered political parties in Burma. That two of them, two fairly large parties, support the military government. The remainder have a tendency to be so-called democracy movements, which are pure CIA creations. If you look at some of the footage of these so-called demonstrations, the signs are in English. The speakers are speaking in English. Who are they talking to? You know, these are people either on the CIA payroll or are educated in the Western world. Liberalism is something that has to be imported and imposed by the West. It's certainly not native to places like China or Burma. But when the military takes over, when a different faction takes over in 1988, their rationale, their justification for the coup is, number one, the existence of ethnic insurgency throughout the country. Number two, drugs, that the ethnic insurgency and the drug trade are tightly connected. And number three, that earlier governments had mismanaged the economy. There's no doubt the Burmese government, as well as the Chinese, fully hold that the CIA is not only involved in the drug trade, but also involved in arming and directing the ethnic insurgencies that have kept Burma permanently at war since independence in the late 40s. And the fact that Burma has registered almost a 6%, if not higher, yearly growth rate since 1988, in the midst of not only sanctions from the West, but civil war and a constant state of warfare with the drug lords who either hide behind communist ideology or ethnic separatist ideology, is very, very impressive. The 6% yearly increase in GDP have occurred in the harshest of circumstances. The military government taking over in 88 held, they still held to a basic sort of social nationalist idea, but they also realized that they needed to open the economy at least to some limited foreign investment, as well as approaching the Chinese so that Burma could take advantage not only of the rising Chinese power, but her high-tech sector and her desire to invest in Burma as a way to check India in Southeast Asia. The military government has laid out that it really has six areas of economic development. The development of exports, certainly oil and natural gas, are important to the West, and one of the reasons they hate the Burmese so much. Resources that require heavy investment, the high-tech sector from China, parts of the economy that are very capital-intensive, regional development. Regional development is important because the military government wants to end these fights with the ethnic groups like the Karen and other groups like this. But the Karen have been instructed by the CIA to not negotiate with the Burmese military government. And so Burma has sought to develop economically these regions and hopes to tie them closer to the Burman majority, which is about 80-85% of the population is a dominant Burman ethnic group. And saving energy. You know, it really tightening up efficiency standards in Burma's growing industry. And of course, the Chinese are also very important in that regard. So they've also lowered taxes. They've lowered customs duties. For citizens, the highest tax rate is 30%. So if you make a lot of money, that's the highest rate. Rates go lower as you make less money. And then for corporate taxes, privately owned or partners with the government, they have been drastically lowered over the years. And the GDP of the country, inflation is the one big problem of the military government is inflation. And it's one of the areas that kind of justified the coup in 1988 was that the former government let the currency, the kyat, go out of control. But from 1990 to 1995, the economy grew from 152,000, let me put it this way, from 152,000 to 604,000. Excuse me, I should say million. Not thousand, million, kyats in terms of its production. Now, inflation did grow in this period of time, and so some of that economic performance has been eroded. And this is the problem. It's been a problem with Burma. It's been a problem with Belarus. It's been a problem with Syria, especially in the 80s. You know, inflation in developing countries is routinely a major problem. The government has overvalued the kyat as well in hopes to control this. But I guess the main battle economically of the military government is that really heavy investment and Chinese assistance is the way to put that money to good use and thus lower the inflation rate. Macroeconomic and fiscal policies really can never be separated from simple economic growth, rational investment. Now, contrary to all the myths told about the military government has been extremely responsive to public needs, especially in the realm of infrastructure, land ownership, the creation of industrial jobs. The Burmese government has been absolutely nothing but stellar in this regard. And of course, since much of this information is either covered over or it only exists in Chinese, it's ignored by the American journalistic, establishment. When we come back, we're going to deal with specifics relative to Burma, economic development, the developing world, social nationalism, and the military forces of the country, and especially relative to both Chinese investment and the Indian threat. So we'll be right back. Hang in there.
Don't go away, because there's more to come on the Orthodox Nationalist. You're listening to the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network. Visit us at reasonradionetwork.com. Return to the Orthodox Nationalist, brought to you by the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network, reasonradionetwork.com.
Okay, one of the myths that's regularly told about enemies of the New World Order, whether it be the Taliban in Afghanistan or the Burmese military, is that they're involved in the drug trade, and that's really almost a mocking attack, because both the Taliban and the Burmese military have spent a fortune in trying to eradicate the drugs in their respective countries. The military has absolutely nothing to gain in the drug trade, and yet this is clearly the means whereby the so-called democracy movement under CIA control has been financed. The only reason that the recent elections in Burma were nullified was because the so-called pro-democracy movement was receiving a fortune in drug money, in CIA money, in Mossad money. And they said, well, therefore, the results of this election can't possibly be valid if the foreign sources are controlling the opposition. But the proof is in the pudding here. And the military government has done everything in its power to develop the country in the midst of near constant warfare. Over 100 dams have been built since 1991. And as of right now, there's about 75 more in production. This is for the sake of irrigation. This is for the sake of electric power. The main form of landholding in Burma is the family farm. The family farm is protected by the Burmese military authorities, and the existence of landlords largely does not exist. About 70% of all of Burmese industry is controlled by small firms, not giant conglomerates. But the government also is very worried about the concept of dependency. Their idea has been development must be internal. It must come from Burmese labor, or at the very least, from a sort of Pan-Asian movement in the country led by China. The military government has increased literacy to almost 95%. Now, what kind of a repressive government wants increases, tremendous increases in literacy? Regional development and a government-controlled regional and agricultural development bank has been created for the sake of giving low-interest or no-interest loans to farmers of minority background in Burma, and as well as entrepreneurs, to build a strong, local, decentralized economy in the country. So regional development, it's really a matter of keeping peace, of destroying the drug trade by giving poppy farmers legitimate crops to grow. The United Nations reports that in the 1990s, poppy production, or I should really say opium production, went down by 75%, although only in areas under military control. The UN also said the exact same thing about the Taliban in Afghanistan after the fall of the Soviet government there, that they simply almost eradicated the poppy trade. So in both cases, both Afghanistan and Burma, you have this accusation that the main elements in attacking the drugs are allegedly selling the drugs. And it's nothing more than propaganda, but since the average person doesn't know anything, you could tell them anything, and they'll buy it. Both the Taliban and the Burmese military have destroyed millions of tons of opium and other narcotics created by the Central Intelligence Agency, Mossad, and their hangers-on in the country. The main opposition, or one of the main oppositions, is called the Shan United Army. And the Shan Army is probably the main CIA military front in Burma, and controls a substantial percentage of the heroin trade in the country. And when the new government put a major general in charge of the bank, the main central bank in Burma, that got George Soros extremely upset. And the point is that all the resources of the country need to be under the only real functioning bureaucratic entity in the entire nation, and that is the military. The military have to control the government because of the drugs, because of the constant warfare. A democratic state backed by the U.S., or I should say liberal democratics. I mean, the Burmese government is democratic in the sense that there is, there are, like I said, over 40 registered political parties, all of whom have their own newspapers and everything else. There's full freedom of speech there. The only problem is you can't go around supporting ethnic separatism and the drug trade. Many of the, these 42 parties that are officially legal and registered are ethnic separatist parties based only in those areas dominated by the ethnic group. Every ethnic group has its own political party, which, as far as the military is concerned, is a huge problem. Russia, for example, has banned all regionally based parties. There are no regionally based parties in the United States, for example. The Canadians spent a lot of money to make sure that the Quebec Nationalists did not win in that province in Canada. So you can't blame the Burmese government in this for this kind of thing. It's a centralized state because it has to be a centralized state. The ability of the U.S. to do much of anything other than internal subversion, it really is now a moot because of the increasing Chinese colonization of the country. So already you see a far more rational, economic and historical, structure that makes, that, you know, that puts the military government in context and makes sense out of it. In the 1940s, under British colonialism, you know, 30% of the economy was totally controlled by foreigners. The British used, or should they, the major British bankers used Burma as a way to ship heroin into China. And these are the same people now who will condemn of the military government for doing the same thing, although there is absolutely no evidence that the military government has had anything to do with drugs, and in fact, according to the UN, is the main fighter against the drug trade. But even more than that, the military government is involved in creating an educational, energy, and agricultural infrastructure with some Chinese money to reach full employment, to take advantage of the high literacy of the Burmese population, to earn extra revenue, and to bring the ethnic minorities into a singular social nationalist Burmese state. It should be noted that several dozen local universities have been built and financed by the military government since 1988, and they need these universities because if they want to develop their high-tech sector, if they want to develop their energy sector, if they want to partner with China in developing these sectors, they need a college-educated population. So I'm not sure what more the military can do. Their record in dealing with the economy and national development is first rate under the circumstances, and their venom is legitimately aimed at separatism and terrorism from the ethnic armies and the Burmese Communist Party and its main, the Shan United Army, and all of these groups are financed by the drug trade. And so the Burmese military says that these parties that are connected to these groups are also, naturally enough, financed by the drug trade. So what democracy are these idiots talking about in Burma? It's drugs, it's CIA and Mossad, it's George Soros, and all of this type, this New World Order movement controlling these parties for their own purpose. That's why the elections have been nullified. Now, the military government, more specifically, is kind of curious. Like a lot of military governments, it's very top-heavy with officers. But the military itself is considered the toughest in Asia, and they're considered the toughest primarily because they're constantly involved in combat. So anyone who wants to take on Burma is going to have to take on the Burmese army, which is one of the most, if not the most, combat tested in the entire world. Burma has a little bit over 50 million people. The total membership of the Burmese military forces are 344,000. That's very, very small relative to the size of the population. But in terms of sheer numbers, they're number 12 worldwide in terms of recruitment. They're about the same as Egypt in that respect. They're one of the lowest in terms of arms imports. They're 80th in the world, about the same as Burkina Faso in Africa and Austria in Europe. It's about $20 million a year in imports. They don't export. Let me put it this way. Their military spending is about 2.1% of the GDP, which is far lower than the United States. 2.1% of GDP for military spending is about the same as Uganda, Portugal, and Finland. So, it may be a military government, but it's certainly not a militarized country. They only have two armored divisions, and their tanks... They have about 3,000 tanks. How many of them actually work? I'm not sure. And they have about 2,000 pieces of artillery. Most of their equipment historically has come from Ukraine and India. Today, that's largely changed, and it's mostly coming from China. The problem is that, you know, you have a relatively small army. You have equipment that comes from all over the world, and therefore is very hard to service. There's not a lot of spare parts. You have a combat-tested army, but not a lot of actual infantrymen that are combat-ready at any given moment. So though it's a military government, the military is relatively small relative to the population. They have about maybe 50 fighters from China, in the Air Force. The Air Force only has about 15,000 members. The Navy has about 19,000 members, most of which really is interior rivers. And the use of smaller gunboats is one of the main ways that, the military has used the river system to fight the ethnic movement. They only have two large guided missile frigates, and these are used to patrol the coastline, of course, which is very, very large in Burma. But now the Chinese have taken over some of that some of those responsibilities. What should be noted is that the Burmese military have trained and financed 19 elite anti-narcotic police units. These are highly mobile, highly trained. They are the best armed in the Burmese military arsenal. And technically they're police forces, but in the military government, they're kind of all connected. And these are the forces used against the drug trade. But that's another way of saying that these are the forces that are used against the ethnic insurgency. There are 16 combat police battalions. We call them SWAT teams in the West. But, you know, the total police force for a country of 50 million is roughly 72,000. So here you have something strange. You have these ridiculous media attacks about Burma being a military government, which is supposed to make us all shudder, you know, because it's automatic that a military government has to be evil. But with a fairly small military, a very small police force, and a lot of money being sent to the elite anti-narcotic sort of paramilitary police forces. So what these figures suggest is that Burma cannot be much of a tyrannical state with fairly small military forces. And a police force, which is very small relative to the population, and is mostly dedicated to anti-drug issues and combat. So the mere statistics of military and police forces in Burma suggest that the American media simply have invented stories, have planted stories. They did the same thing in Serbia and Kosovo. And they could get away with it largely because no one knows anything about this part of the world. Burma is largely a black spot to most people. And so they could pretty much say whatever they want, and there's really no one who could say anything about it. The military government has created a basic economic success story relative to circumstances. If you use the measure of purchasing power parity, Burma is the 67th largest economy in the world. So about a little bit above, halfway from the highest to the lowest. It's about the same as Syria or Bulgaria. And, but just to put it in context, Burma is the 67th largest economy in the world. Lithuania is the 84th, and Estonia is the 105th. And so when you look at Burmese infrastructure development, educational development, literary development, 95% literacy, when you look at her industrial and energy development, which is central to the military rule right now, you see a very impressive growth rate relative to circumstances. And now that Burma, to a great extent, is connected with China, that growth is just going to increase. So the situation is that the West has really almost become obsessed with Burma. There's TV shows about it, and they claim that the military, I've actually heard these claims, military kills babies, the military rapes elephants. the military shoots anything that moves. There's no evidence for this whatsoever. And one of my favorite accusations, you know, George Soros created this whole thing about child soldiers. And, of course, there's not a shred of evidence for that kind of thing. The International Labor Organization was permitted to engage in a lengthy study of both the Burmese military and Burmese labor conditions from 2001 to 2002. So a solid year, the ILO scoured the Burmese countryside and found no evidence whatsoever of forced labor, no evidence of child soldiers, although there were child soldiers in the sometimes as young as 10 in the ethnic armies, but into the official army there is none. I believe that the youngest you could be is 17 in Burma. It might be 18, and there is no draft, by the way, although that may change, so I've heard, but there is no draft as of right now. And they simply, there is no accusation too wild or too insane that the system has not put on the Burmese armed forces. The fact is that the Chinese and the International Labor Organization, Thailand, other countries in the region have made it clear that the Burmese army is very professional, is extremely well trained. Their equipment could be better, but that may change as well. And since the main policy thrust of the government right now is regional development to unify the ethnic groups with the central authorities, there's absolutely nothing to gain by these kind of atrocities. But this is typical atrocity propaganda. It occurs in every war. It happens all the time. The only difference is that modern academics and talking heads buy it. And they buy it because they don't know anything. They buy it because they're paid to buy it. Because that's what really a talking head is. But what we're looking at in Southeast Asia is the growth of a powerful pan-Asian economic bloc dedicated to social nationalism, dedicated to sovereignty, and dedicated to doing battle with the New World Order. The Shanghai Five Trade Association, with Russia as one of the members, is another example of this. The Group of 77 is another example of this. And that's why Burma is in the crosshairs, because she is one of the major ingredients in China's war against the New World Order. The Chinese government has made it clear that national sovereignty, regional economic blocs, are the primary components of her foreign policy now. The creation of a multipolar world rather than a singular U.S.-led New World Order. And this is the nature of Chinese policy. And if you guys remember George Soros in 1997, speculated against the Thai baht, which is their currency, and brought down the entire East Asian economic system, with the exception of China. Of course, the Chinese yuan is state controlled. And so China then has had to respond to George Soros by building this regional bloc against this kind of banking, New World Order, speculation, Judaic mentality. And so this is the fault of the regime. To the extent that they don't like these governments, there's very good reason for these governments to have come into existence, and is nothing but hypocrisy, stupidity, and ignorance, as always. That goes into the so-called analysis on this question. So again, we have dealt with the question of social nationalism, the New World Order, and the question of Eurasianism, And Russia is very closely connected to this through the Shanghai Five anti-New World Order trading bloc. And one of these days we're going to talk about the Shanghai Five. I don't know when that's going to be, but it will happen eventually. And so this concept, states, countries, ideologies, political systems that are involved in these trading blocs to fight the New World Order. Now, it's been the theme of this radio broadcast, whether it be in philosophy or in theology or in politics or in history or whatever. That's been our purpose. I thank you for listening, and I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening. The Orthodox Nationalist returns Thursday evening, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.